Okay, this is an oral history interview with Dr. Amram Katz. Interviewers are Joe Todorovich speaking and Martin Collins. And the date is July 24th, 1986 at 2:30 approximately in the afternoon. And we are at Dr. Katz's home just outside Santa Monica, California. We'd like to start way back for our biography questions and ask you where you were born and who your parents were.
I was born in Chicago on August 15, 1915, in a lying-in hospital. My dad was named Max Katz. My mother, Lena. When I was less than a year old, I moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I spent my early years.
What were their occupations?
My mother was a housewife. My dad had several different occupations during his career. He wound up as a building manager, managing his properties. He had a terrible accident when I was about 2 or 3 years old. Got his leg caught in an elevator, which was not up to safety standards, between the elevator and the floor. He lost his leg. And this, unless you knew him, you'd not be able to tell that he had this handicap. Because he had the most marvelous sense of humor of anyone I've ever known. I grew up in Milwaukee, did all the normal things, lived in a community where nobody I knew had a car, people were poor, but it wasn't until years later that I realized we were poor. Mm-hmm. This came to me as a revelation. I figured it out, but given the constraints I had at the time, so I must have been poor.
Were there any brothers and sisters?
I have two younger brothers that are separated from me by 5 and 10 years, respectively. One of them now lives in Bellingham, Washington. And the younger of the two brothers lives in Milwaukee. I went to school in Milwaukee, graduated from West Division High School.
Did you, just to back up a little bit, did you read very much as a child? What sorts of childhood interests did you have?
I was interested in everything, as I recall. I read books like mad. I read story at very high speed. Not at the Evelyn Wood speed.
Mm-hmm.
Which speed is designed to have you read stuff fast, stuff that never should have been written.
Could I ask you to just raise the microphone up just a little bit? It's
sure.
Scraping on your tie there. And, that's fine. What kinds of books did you read?
I read a lot of history, a lot of travel, not much science. I was particularly interested in that as a kid. In high school, I was an associate editor of the high school paper. And this impressed me so much that I thought I'd go into journalism. When I entered college my first year in 32, 33, I went to school at the University of Wisconsin Extension Division in Milwaukee, which was about 6 blocks from my house.
Mm-hmm. How did you choose that? Was it the proximity or the location in the...
There was no big choice of schools. Went to the closest, cheapest one. We were lucky to get in there.
Mm-hmm.
Did I entered you? Just in the middle of the Depression. Depression affected us all. I had plenty to eat, clothes, and eat in the house. So I guess we rode out the Depression comfortably.
Did your brothers go to college also?
Yes. My second brother, 5 years younger than I am, went to school at the University Extension for a year or two and went to Madison. And then he got drafted, became a meteorologist, got out of the Army, and took his master's degree in meteorology at Penn State, I believe. My younger brother, 10 years younger than me, went to school in Madison, didn't finish there. I don't know, I guess he did finish there. Took a degree in optometry, Northern Illinois College of Optometry. Practiced that in Milwaukee for a few years. And got into a real estate business, became a very successful contractor, builder, and real estate manager.
When you were leaving high school and going into college, besides journalism, were there any other strong interests that you had?
Last year of high school, I got interested in astronomy. I got swept up with some amateur astronomers. I became active in that, built a telescope, found a couple of mirrors, and that led me into an interest in physics. I was fortunate in that this University Extension in Milwaukee had some full professors who were doing mostly teaching, not research. I'll turn the handle. And this University Extension was so structured that freshmen taking physics courses could have the benefit of listening to a full professor in physics who was a marvelous teacher. As a result, I switched my major from journalism to physics and math.
Mm-hmm. Who was this teacher?
This was a chap named Miles J. Martin. I ran into Martin once after the war. I have no idea where he was, what he's doing. I had a full professor in German and a full professor in chemistry. It's altogether a remarkable introduction to college life. I went to that extension for 3 years instead of normal two. It enabled me to take a few extra math courses. And then the following fall in 35, I went to Madison, where I fell into a deal of some sort, a complicated deal, which enabled me to be in the graduate school as an undergraduate. I took lots of graduate courses, never took a graduate degree.
This was the graduate school in physics?
In physics.
At Madison?
Yes.
But before we move on to the graduate courses, how did you support yourself, or how were you supported during this time? Did you have to work, or was there any kind of aid available?
I worked for NYA, National Youth Authority, for a while, and got pay was 35 cents and 40 cents an hour, which was great. But that wasn't my major support. My major support came from my folks directly. I didn't have any other jobs to support myself.
Okay, so you arrive at Madison and you're taking graduate courses, but you're not exactly a graduate student. You're not in a degree track.
I knew I wasn't in a degree track. I eventually spent 4 years in Madison, and on the way out, I took my bachelor's degree. So I spent 7 years in college. The last thing I did was pay with a bachelor's degree. And I find it maybe sound like sour grapes, not intended to sound that way, that PhD is not really required. The only time you need it is when you're being introduced and doing a speech. At that time, you get it automatically.
And through this time, were you considering careers choices at all?
This is peculiar. I've thought about this often. I was going to talk to my kids, other people who were active in college during the years I was there. We didn't have any career in mind. Nobody knew what a career in physics was like. There was nothing to look at. No data available. The only thing that we knew was people that take physics teach physics. So the only career that seemed to open up was teaching. I use open up in a loose sense. I hate to say this, but we didn't have anything in mind. We had no plan, no nothing. A lot of unemployment in the 30s. In fact, a few years later, I was at Wright Field in Dayton working for the U.S. Army Air Corps, later become the Air Force. And they, when Pearl Harbor was bombed, they had to do something, so I thought they commissioned the civilian scientists and engineers. But they never heard of physicists. It was still a rare item, believe it or not. So physicists were going to be drafted, engineers were going to become lieutenants. It wasn't until a little while later, in 42, 43, that physics became a subject and people paid particular attention to physicists. That's very odd. I had no career in mind. And in fact, my first job was with the government in Washington, the Census Bureau. And it's unbelievable how I got there. Along with everybody else, it's unbelievable how they got there. What happened was this, in the spring of fall of 38 or January 39, sometime like that, this date is recoverable if it's a matter of precision. I can't remember the date now. There was an examination posted, civil service exam posted around the country for a student fingerprint classifier with the FBI. And every college senior in the United States took that exam. 140,000 people were on that civil service register. There were two jobs. They could have fined us out $1 million a day for the cost of giving that exam and marking it and running that. Then those two jobs were filled, I guess. Nobody ever heard from the FBI. But there was this register sitting with all these names. And along came the 1940 decennial census with a requirement to hire a large number of temporary people. Somebody had a bright idea of picking up this register, and they started hiring off the top. And this became such a funny joke that all they had to do is know your grade, and they knew what day you reported for work. It was a one-to-one correlation between your score on the exam and the date you were hired. So the caste system was set up in the Census Bureau according to the date of hire. My score on that exam was 97.7. And there were some people that were there before I got there. They had done 98.2. Some guys came a couple weeks after I did, they did 96.7. Pecking order was set up.
So they were. You were all aware of this,
sure.
And there was this hierarchy.
There's this hierarchy, and whatever we wanted was status. We were classified as CAF-3. CAF was a civil service classification, which stood for clerical, administrative, fiscal, not professional. Mm-hmm. CAF-3. And we thought that's pretty hot stuff, because we were paid, the hiring paper said we were going to be paid $3.95 a day. That was our pay. This sounds ridiculous, but it turns out to be $14.40 a year. And we got the job, and next thing we wanted was permanent civil service status. You're getting a P list, professional 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's GS now. Mm-hmm. P1 was GS, is equivalent to GS5. And titles went with this, like in royalty. Junior physicist, assistant physicist, associate physicist, physicist, senior physicist, chief physicist. And I don't know what the hell the others are. I don't know if you ever heard of them. But we used to have these ratings in such awe and admiration that when I worked in the Census Bureau, we originally worked in the Commerce Department building, a huge building on 14th Street. Mm-hmm. And there was a famous economist working on the hall in the Bureau of Foreign and Domestic Commerce, Bob Nathan. You may have heard of him. He's the guy that invented the concept of national income, GNP, and so on. He was a P5. That's now a GS. GS-13.
What exactly?
And when he walked in the hall, the word used to be flashed to all the clerks. There's a P5 walking down the hall. Go out and look at him.
What kind of work were you doing as a clerk?
Well, I got snapped up by W. Edwards Deming.
Can you spell Deming for us?
D-E-M-I-N-G. He was a famous statistician. He promoted a few mathematicians and physicists out of that stockpile into a statistical research unit. They're doing amazing things. I heard of statistics for the first time in my life when I got there, mathematical statistics. Wisconsin didn't know anything about that. I don't think it was a course in that given.
It was strictly experimental.
What?
Wisconsin.
The math department didn't have any mathematical statistics courses. Mm-hmm. It was a new subject. It was in 39 and 40. There have been people working in it. It was possible at that time to own all the books and statistics and have them occupy half of that shelf. It's no longer possible to do anything like that. It's a full library of books. So I took some statistics courses at the Department of Agriculture Graduate School. It was a wonderful school. I learned something about mathematical statistics. So I worked in there for a guy named Morris Hansen. A very bright, self-educated economist, I think. He learned mathematical statistics and was very good at it. But I stayed there about a year and a half, went to Wright Field. Because war was declared the day I moved to Washington, September 1st, 1939. Within a day or two of that, I was there and war was declared. And then we realized we ought to do something with our statistics or our physics or something. But the civil service system worked in the following way. Somebody in Dayton, Ohio, at Wright Field, would request three names. They had to get three at a time. You couldn't hire some guy just like that. You know, hire three names, get three names, three guys off the top of the register. And you examine the credentials, you interview them, you test them, you pick one. You know, the two guys get thrown back in the pot. Well, my name went out, and I didn't get the job. The job was as an X-ray technician in a materials laboratory. I never found out what the job involved. I was glad I didn't get it. But they didn't send my name back. So I was in limbo. I wasn't available. I didn't have a job for months. Finally, I got another call from right field, which I treated with great caution, to come out for an interview. So in a photo lab, I knew about photography. I didn't know much about photography. I didn't, never developed any film or I knew which way to point a camera. Lens goes out.
Had you still kept your interest in amateur astronomy through
sure.
through these years?
Yeah.
Had you done any more in lens grinding or
no.
anything like that?
No. My major activity as an amateur astronomer was observing SS Cygni, a variable star. A big contest among the amateur astronomers. See who could have posted the greatest number of readings on amateur on variable stars. That was a big activity in Milwaukee and elsewhere.
Yeah, were you a member of any formal organization?
I think I was a member at one time of the Amateur Astronomers of Milwaukee. But I can't prove that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. It was a loose organization.
Yeah. Did you submit your observations to
right.
AAVSO?
Yes, Harvard College.
Mm-hmm.
And you just get thank you cards, incredibly so many observations. I never was in the running for a competition because this place where the telescope was, where we used it, was about an hour and a half streetcar ride from where I lived. And the idea of going there and waiting until it gets dark and observing all night, coming home at 5 in the morning, was something I couldn't do every day. I do a couple of days a week. It was a great activity.
Did you keep this up while you were in school?
No, in college?
So,
no.
In college?
Well, for a year while I was in Milwaukee Extension, I did, but not more.
Yeah. And one other thing before we move to Dayton, and that is, I'd like to know a little bit more about what your interests were in physics during the it was 7 years that you spent. What sorts of aspects of physics interested you the most?
I was not in nuclear physics at all.
Not nuclear physics.
Not nuclear physics. I was interested in experimental vacuum techniques. And making mirrors and step wedges and things like that, experimental physics.
So you did a lot of fabrication, a lot of manipulation of materials.
Yes.
In that as part of the physics. And you got involved greater in, so you had some substantial involvement in optics then.
Yes. But all the optics I learned after I went to right field.
Okay, so let's then go to right field, and you're in the photo lab. You're assigned to the.
I was assigned to the photo lab. I had a chap I worked for. Who one day told me, "There are three things I'm not interested in: cameras, photography, and airplanes." Here I was in the airplane photography business. I didn't know what to make of this observation. This came to a head one day when the B-19 came to Wright Field. I know you've never heard of the B-19. This was the world's biggest airplane. It was had twice the wingspread of a B-17 and four little engines on it. And these engines barely got this thing off the ground. When this airplane flew, you could look south and see it flying. Go back and read a book for 10 minutes, come back, it wouldn't move very far from a place in the sky. It looked like a butterfly flying. It was the world's biggest airplane. It had wheels that were 7 feet high, as I recall. I was down in the basement of the laboratory building. I couldn't go run out to the airfield to see this as everybody else was doing unless my boss gave me permission. I said to him, "Clarence, let's go see the B-19. He said, what's that? I said, Jesus, it's the world's biggest goddamn airplane. He said, well, how big is it? I said, Jesus, it's twice as big as the B-17. And he said, if I want to see that, I'll stand twice as close to the B-17. So I had a problem. It's absolutely true. You couldn't make up a story like that.
You were on pretty good terms with your boss. You're calling him by his first name.
Yes.
What kind of work were you doing in the photo lab? What were you?
Well, that's interesting.
Your duties.
We had this guy, George Goddard, gave a paper on him as laboratory boss. And he knew a few physicists and appreciated their work. Put me in the sensitometry laboratory. Sensitometry laboratory dealt with film. And we make sure that the film batches we were getting from Eastman Kodak had the HD curve as advertised and were of sufficient sensitivity. So we had a gigantic sensitometer which enabled us to impress on a piece of film an HD curve. We'd measure calibrated light values, we knew how much energy was going in. Mm-hmm. So I spent quite a bit of time reading those curves, which involved a spot photometer where you match the density of the step wedge with a known calibrated density, and you can see when it's high or low, and it was quite a sensitive instrument. It was dull work. I had an interest in camera shutters, and I worked out a measuring device for camera shutters, which is much better than the device they had, which looked like it came from an 1893 fair. Very primitive. It's described in this book. I'll tell you about this book in a couple of minutes.
Okay. This is for the tape. This is Herbert E. Ives' Airplane Photography is the title of the book. And what is the date of
copyright 1920. That's very much we said about that book, which I'll say in a minute or two.
Okay.
My interest in camera shutters. We set about a program, which I can describe to you as a logical program, which isn't the way the program evolved. The description I put on it after we looked back and see what the hell we did, you can only tell a story logically, but it wasn't logical at all. I worked out testing methods for shutters. We worked with NDRC, that's OSRD, Office of Scientific Research and Development, and started some shutter projects to improve the speed of shutters. Well, we could see airplanes were getting faster, and you want to take sharp pictures, the only way to take sharp pictures is to have a short exposure time. Later during the war, we cooked up the idea of moving film, which is how those things are done now. Film moves during the exposure to keep up with the image speed. Mm-hmm. You're riding forward in an airplane, the airplane's going this way, the film's moving in the same direction, because the object is going by the opposite direction. I compensate for a blur and so on. Mm-hmm. So I got into that, and I got into lens testing in the same laboratory. And then Goddard wanted us physicists to fly. He said, you're not going to learn anything about this subject if you just stay in the laboratory. He's right. So he insisted we take pictures, develop pictures ourselves. So he issued everybody who wanted one a speed graphic, 4x5 camera, all the free film. All the weekends you want to take pictures, develop them yourself, print them, learn the subject.
So
that was great.
The laboratory, for all of the film you were testing at your first job within the film lab, this was all for reconnaissance photography.
Yes.
That was the main focus of this laboratory at Wright. Or
that was the only focus.
It was the only focus of the laboratory at Wright. And how did you go from your work on calibrating and testing these batches of film to designing the shutter. How did you pick that up?
I stopped doing one thing, I did something else. There's no transition.
There's no transition.
No relation.
Did you get interested in it? Did somebody assign you to another project, or did you just get interested in mechanisms?
I got interested in camera shutters. Mm-hmm. And I must have got permission to do it, because I was doing it. We were in a kind of bullpen laboratory with offices off. It's hard to describe it. So I would be testing shutters. In fact, the shutter tester I evolved became the American standard. And Krause helped me go long distance on that project, because I didn't know much about electronics. Again, oscilloscope, a Dumont 175A, I think it was called. And we wired a photocell and a light behind the shutter, and then put the shutter, and it hit the photocell. The photocell plotted the aperture curve. And then we put an audio oscillator on this thing and chopped it up into milliseconds, so we could count how many milliseconds it was open. And we had enough data, so we drew shutter efficiency curves as it opens. And for focal plane shutters, we evolved a different kind of a tester. We were soon doing experiments. I don't know how we got into all these things. We just had something to be done, so we'd pick it up and do it.
Mm-hmm. Had you had, in your physics training, some exposure to electronics?
No.
At all? Did you just pick that up?
I picked up a little I had, which isn't much. Mm-hmm. By talking to Krause and a guy in our laboratory who was an electronic guy working elsewhere. This doesn't make much sense now, but I think it's accurate to report it didn't make much sense at the time either.
Okay.
That's the way it was. Then one day we got the idea that lenses aren't taking sharp pictures. We looked into lots of reasons why. We wanted to know how sharp the pictures were. We had resolution tests in the laboratory. We had a three-line target, which works like this. Here's three lines. Right pattern, three lines going in the horizontal direction. This is the pitch. That's the width of one line. With one line is a tenth of a centimeter, and clearly there are 10 such lines per centimeter. And we made targets which had this spacing, and eventually we went down to the cube root of 2, variation between spacing, and we went down to the sixth root of 2 to get finer readings. We have a pattern consisting of big lines like this and smaller lines down to, most we ever got in the laboratory was about 25 lines per millimeter. I tell you, you photograph this at the end of a collimator, have a big lens, mm-hmm. and project the target. And photograph that target, the lens, and then we examine the pattern. And usually this would be clearly resolved, it was big. And the last targets down the line were not resolved at all. So you look up here, you find which pattern was resolved, you know what the calibration of that pattern is. And you say the resolution of that lens is 15 lines per millimeter, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we test the lens at various angular positions. And the reason is historic results can't be used, these tests can't be used anymore, because it's really limited by the collimator. We had an old Goerz, G-O-E-R-Z, Dogmar lens, Ogmar. That wasn't very good. And so we replaced it with a paraboloid reflector mirror, which Baker designed for us. Resolution improved. Then after talking about this for a couple of months, I decided to make some aerial tests. I didn't need anybody's permission at this stage. What I did is take some big blotting paper for prints. Paper was about so big. I have black sheets and white sheets.
It's about 1 yard square, roughly.
1 yard square. Mm-hmm. And I made lines out of that and nailed it to the ground. I got the first picture somewhere in this office. We would never tell where it was. Here was the right field. These are runways, a mile or so in length. And right field had been experimenting with an accelerated runway. They had the broad idea they could take an airplane up the hill. How they got there, I don't know. It's not thought out very well. And paved a piece of concrete going down the hill. And let the airplane get a flying start. So this was a noticeable location. It was an eccentric idea, right angle of a runway. So directly in this little corner here, which served as a good checkpoint to tell the pilot where to fly over.
Okay.
I nailed these things to the ground, literally. I got some pictures which proved what we knew, what we didn't have proof of, that we weren't getting very good resolution in the air. As long as you're taking a low altitude picture, you don't want to miss that. Because low altitude detail is so big it swamps the sharpness, but if you're at high altitude, 30, 40,000 feet, more severe requirements on you because the detail is small. Mm-hmm. Let me see if I've got some pictures here.
Okay, so just with the tape, this accelerator runway, which is inclined, feeds at right angles into the middle of one of the conventional runways, and this target is placed just in the right angle outside the two runways, but where the accelerated runway joins the conventional runway.
This is a picture which shows taking at the same time or the same object, two cameras. This camera had moving film. This camera did not. You can see the amount of blur in here. Everything is blurred in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
About a quarter of an inch or half an inch.
For the tape, this is IVVDCEFA, 28 May 51, comparison test. Dash IMC.
That's image motion compensation.
Image motion compensation versus no image motion compensation. IMC vs. no IMC. And this taken by a 6-inch K-17C, 400 feet, 225 miles per hour at 1/50th of a second at F-22 with 4.8 inches per second image motion compensation.
So this is a nice picture and this is a terrible picture.
Mm-hmm.
See, the airplane was going 225 miles an hour. That's about 300 feet a second or more. A 50th of a second exposure means 6 feet of motion at 300 feet per second. During a 50th of a second, the subject has moved.
Mm-hmm.
So this looks like a very sharp picture, but it's not very sharp in terms of lines per millimeter.
Yeah.
Everything is crystal clear. It's big. There's no substitute for getting close to an object.
So I'm not exactly clear then what purpose the target served that you set by the right angle runway.
The target served the purpose of in some we've been talking about in terms of lines per millimeter, the currency of the laboratory.
So how did you determine that the problem was the the motion of the aircraft and not something else? Was that because you were flying so low that all the other effects had to be negligible?
Yes, in the case of that picture I showed you, that was true.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of high altitude pictures, there are lots of things that cloud over the picture. As a matter of fact, if we had started out in the subject, say, here's an airplane, can we take a picture from it? And turn the problem over to a couple of physicists, they'd prove you couldn't take a picture from the airplane. It's a little difficult, you have to take a picture of your kid on a weekend. Keep them in focus, have them stand still, not blur, follow the motion. So there's vibration, there's temperature effects, there's index of refraction effects. Nothing good happens when you take a camera in an airplane. That's not good. Bad things happen. And vibration can be just as ornery as image motion compensation. Image motion without compensation. So we worked on all those things. Not systematically.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the war on, we had requirements from the field. Get cameras out.
You mentioned George Goddard earlier in the context of the laboratory. And you presume he was director of the laboratory when you got there?
Yes, he was a major at the time. And his second in command was a Major Cabell, C-A-B-E-L-L, who later wound up as deputy director of CIA, four-star general. But Goddard was a remarkable man. He was very unmilitary, as I've written.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't care much about military except photography and flying and long focal lengths, and bigger and higher and faster and lower and darker. He was a photographic nut. It's just what it took.
Let me just flip the tape over. We're getting to the end of this is the end of side A, tape 1.